All right. This is Roger Eardley Pryor. I'm at the Energy Co-op for an oral history with Damali Rett. Today is July 13th, 2017. Damali, could you tell me how you spell your name?
So Damali is spelled D-A-M-A-L-I. And the history of my name is my father actually had the name before he even met my mother.
Ah.
He found the name in a Yoruba praise poem. And
in a what is
Yoruba?
It?
So Yoruba is a considered a people, like one of the Nigerian peoples.
Mm.
You're kind of Yoruba, or there's kind of all those various kind of groups.
Mm.
And the name means beautiful vision, and so he knew he wanted a daughter, and he knew that was going to be her name. Here is a fun fact of Philly history. There was a writer, she actually has since passed away, but she was based here, named Ellie Banks, and she wrote a book about a vampire huntress, and the vampire huntress's name was Damali.
Yes.
And this was years and years ago, and I actually emailed her. And she said I was the first Damali to reach out to her. And she was actually based in Philly, interestingly enough. So I actually need to go back and read those series, because the series were based here as their home base. And
She
started off here, and then they wound up traveling the world, and she wound up writing 13 books.
Wow.
And so it was very interesting in that particular series, how she wrote the books and what happened and how she worked through them. And so
I love it. When were you born?
I was born in 77.
Okay.
So I was born...
Where were you born?
October 17, 77 in Cleveland.
Oh, right on.
In Cleveland.
Did you spend most of your childhood in Cleveland?
I did not. And so my mom just graduated from college. And so my dad was already... I actually grew up in D.C. And so my dad was actually already in D.C. So kind of after the period where they knew I was going to be fine, when I was 6 weeks old, I moved to D.C. And so I grew up in Washington.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents? What are their names?
So my mom is Enid Doggett, and so she was born in Cleveland, is from Cleveland, still, but lives in D.C. now, so has lived in D.C. for the last 40 years.
Mm.
My dad is Walter Rett Jr., and he was actually born in Virginia, but mostly grew up in Virginia, a little bit in Virginia, but mostly in South Carolina.
Mm.
And so all of our family on his side is in about 25 miles outside of Charleston in a town called Somerville.
Okay.
And so...
Do you have siblings as well?
I do not. So I'm the only one.
Yeah. How did your mom and dad meet then?
My dad was her TA.
Oh, yes.
In college. And so they met. My dad went to Ohio State, and my mom, being from Cleveland, she didn't go. She actually went to Ohio University.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's interesting is my dad and his brother both went to Ohio State. My mom went to Ohio University, and so I'm very much this Ohio State, you know, Ohio girl, like
yeah.
The whole Ohio State versus Michigan.
Yes.
Piece. I always got to go with my Buckeyes.
I grew up in Ohio, so you're speaking to the choir.
Yeah, so... And so, like, and it's interesting, too, because my mom has several cousins that went to Ohio State, but they met when my mom was in college, and so my dad was getting a master's, and so was doing some work at Ohio University, and so they met there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What was it that your dad was teaching and getting his M.A. in?
His M.A. is in urban studies, and so his, I may get this wrong now. I believe his undergraduate's in Black history.
Awesome.
And so he actually is, now he kind of just writes for himself, but he's a specialist in Southern history, particularly around both Southern economics and kind of thinking through like Charleston. And at one point, Charleston Perlo rice was worth its weight in gold, literally, and, you know, kind of thinking through some of that. And then now writes, he's actually was named one of the New York Times did a feature on 19 commenters that comment on the New York Times. And he was one of those commenters out of, like, I think, like, 30,000 active commenters.
Wow.
And so he, like, has this whole following in this whole piece. My mother actually went to school for journalism.
Mm.
And so she wound up, she worked kind of as a journalist behind the scenes for a little bit when I was younger. So they were divorced when I was five, and so they were both in D.C., so I was actually going back and forth between the two houses a lot in kind of a non-traditional arrangement. But grew up, you know, kind of working with, if you're familiar with the news radio station in D.C., the big one is TOP, mm-hmm. which still exists. And so my mom was working as a reporter for TOP. And so I used to go to the newsroom and desk, you know, when I was like a little kid and
wow.
would sleep under the desk and thought it was like the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. And so my mom wound up transitioning into public relations. Mm-hmm. And so she's actually the co-op's public relations person now.
The co-op here.
The co-op here. Yeah. So, because I got to go with the best.
Of course.
And so just knowing her work and knowing what she's been able to do. And so she's moved into public relations. And so she did that recently, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, she decided to go on her own. But mm-hmm. prior to that, you know, held a number of, you know, director of communications roles and VP roles, working for both various organizations as well as, you know, traditional public relations firms
yeah.
as well.
Yeah. So. Oh, that's odd. I love hearing the story of them coming together, too, in Ohio, of all places. So your dad, you mentioned your dad did undergrad in Black Studies, but by the late 70s, he's getting his master's. So he must have been one of the earliest generations of people taking those Black Studies courses.
He was, actually, and he was still very much, it's interesting in that, you know, you can imagine in the 70s going to Ohio State. So he was actually the first, in Somerville, he was actually the first Black graduate of his high school. And in Ohio State, I mean, you still had, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's very, very, very few. You know how big that campus
yeah,
is.
Huge. And so 50,000 more? Yeah.
You know, all of the very small number of Black students on that campus in
yes.
the 70s with everything going on. And so doing that and having that, you know, the ability to do that, he definitely was one of the first. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
And what was growing up in Reagan-era 1980s D.C. like?
Well, I tell people, it's interesting, I was watching a video on D.C.'s food culture, because mm-hmm. we have a particular, and it's true, and somebody said there really are two Washingtons, right? There's the Washington that happens when you live there, and then there's the political Washington. And to the extent that you choose to be in one or the other is really up to you. Mm-hmm. Like, my parents are obviously fairly active in the community and doing things. And I was 6, you know, working on Marion Barry's campaign,
yes.
you know, stuffing envelopes. And so I was always kind of in both, but I think not having an understanding of, you know, Reagan and kind of what he was doing, you know, I didn't have to be involved in that. And
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't really until I actually did a congressional internship when I was in college. And I worked for Ron Dellums, he announced his retirement when I was doing the internship. And so this was mm. 97.
Mm.
And he was a Black congressman from the Bay Area, had been in Congress 27 years-ish.
Wow.
22 or 27 years. But this was during the whole when, like, Newt Gingrich was really, like, running the House.
Yes.
It was really, like, a big deal. And it was really interesting walking through various congressional offices or houses and seeing people and, like, literally just running into, like, Newt in the hallway, right? You know, because that's what would happen. In particular, also because Congressman Dellums had already been in office for so long, so he's very senior. He had been on a number of committees
mm-hmm.
and that kind of whole process. So it's really interesting kind of understanding the inner workings and seeing that and seeing how, you know, people come in the breaks and getting that insider's view. And so that was really probably my first really insider's view into kind of the political Washington
hmm.
versus being in this whole, you know, and I grew up inside the city limits. So I went to D.C. public schools
hmm.
all my life, you know, grew up inside D.C. and seeing the difference in between the two. But even then, I think I really understood, you know, I fully understood the difference in traveling to different schools, the difference in my schools versus other schools, even back then, because
mm-hmm.
I went to one of the few schools in D.C. that had academic programs. And now, actually, one of the things I love is that they really made a much more concerted effort, particularly at the high school level, for high schools to really push and develop, you know, various programs and various, you know, bringing in outsiders and making them the same level of kind of academic rigor across the schools. Mm. And so you have a school that when I grew up was notorious, where they just last year, all 100% of their senior class, you know, got college acceptance letters.
Wow.
Right? And so the difference in between when I grew up and seeing that, you know, is huge.
Yeah. Well, tell me about what was the name of the elementary schools that you went to in D.C.?
So I went to Hearst, which was a very small two-floor elementary school, 150 kids between K through 6.
Well, that's intimate.
Very, very intimate. And it was actually, interestingly enough, on the campus behind Sidwell Friends. And so if you're familiar, Sidwell Friends is where, like, Chelsea Clinton went, where the Obama girls went.
Okay.
So it's kind of like the default... it's a Quaker school, so Sidwell Friends. It's a Quaker school, but definitely very, you know, she, lots of fancy folks there. And interestingly enough, didn't really have any much interact with Sidwell kids, because the way that their entrance is, their main entrance is on the other side of their campus versus our side. But very small school.
Is that something you remember noticing as a kid?
Not really. I noticed it more as an adult, because then I started driving past it, like, during my commute, and I was like, oh, this is probably why, because this is actually the front entrance and not that. And my school, though, I realized two things kind of later, but one is we had, because that area of D.C. has a lot of embassies, we had a ton of embassy kids, right? Our, like, international days would be, like, I still have, you know, off the chain.
Yeah. Right? Tell me about it. What are some of your memories?
We just had so many people, like, instead of just, you know, parents trying to put together a costume, you would have people just basically coming from the embassy with, like, full food and, like, costume and just drinks and just... And so the level of people in my class was very, very mixed, both from a diversity standpoint, from a socioeconomic standpoint, and then from an international standpoint. And so growing up,
how lucky.
I realized my best friend was from Brazil and Portuguese, and I realized now her family was actually poor. And it's interesting because the house that she lived in now probably would go for like $1 million because it's been regentrified. But back then, that was not a good area of the city. And I didn't realize, like, you know, you're the kid.
You don't know
care about
it,
that.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I grew up with, like, just varying, you know, people from all over and knowing people from all over and seeing people from all over and just having these multitude of experiences. And then because we were so small, you know, like, we had a parent who... he wasn't even in my class. His kid wasn't in my class. His kid was like three classes ahead of us. But his dad was an archaeologist. And so every year we did like a dig out back.
Wow.
Right? Like my school. Or we, like, a couple of times we went up to, like, you know, various places in the city and did like a little dig with like the shovels and the dust things to dust things off. And we never really found anything. But also we had one parent who was, he actually had a couple kids in the school. He was an architect. I mean, we built a model ski, like we drew plans and did it to scale. I built a model ski chalet in sixth grade.
Wow.
Right? Like,
I didn't even know what a ski chalet was.
We had pictures, yeah. We had options.
Yeah.
And I was like, I like this. It's slanted, you know, the traditional slanted. I was like, I want to build this. And so thinking about, you know, those experiences and how... You know, the exposure, and I tell people now, one of my big things is just exposure to things. And so where I've done a lot of volunteering and talking and speaking to things, it's more really just to tell people that you have options, like that this worldview is not the only worldview.
Yeah, there's more to the world out there. Yeah.
There's way more to the world out there. And so I wound up, so kind of moving forward,
well, thinking back to having these kinds of experiences in elementary school and having these parents that are involved in this really cool work and involved in the community there, what was your vision for what you were going to go out and into the world and do as a child?
Well, I had none, right? As a kid, I had no idea what I wanted to be. No. And I think I
it wasn't like, I want to grow up and be or do.
No, I think the thing that was probably consistent is I always loved books. Mm. And it's funny, I was talking to another woman and we're like, we shouldn't have been reading those books at 12.
Like what?
Like, a young kid should never read The Bluest Eye by, like, Toni Morrison. Or, like, we were reading, like, Greek mythology at, like, 12.
Do you remember the impact that especially The Bluest Eye or
it didn't have, like, I didn't look at them with an adult, and I think that's one of the things is, you know, you see pictures and people talk about like this, it's as a kid I never internalized that because I didn't understand, you don't always fully understand the depth of what you're reading. And so for you it's just you're just losing yourself in various worlds. And I mean, I would just read the encyclopedia, like back when they had, you know, the kids' encyclopedias and just be, you know, have a good time with that.
Wow.
And so
pre-internet traveling the world,
pre-internet, right? Pre, you know, what have you. And so I think you know, from my standpoint, it just didn't, it, I think I'm still a reader, so I think it just makes you just start liking reading. And so kind of moving forward, I think one of the things, two things kind of set me on the path I am today. So I was accepted into Andover, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Phillips Academy Andover.
Yes.
And so they actually have a summer program called Math and Science for Minority Students. And they fly in for three summers. They go around the country and they do interviews and things like that. And they bring in a group. I don't know how many of us there were. I want to say there were probably about 30 or 40 of us from all around the country. And we go to Andover for 6 weeks in the summer. And we take math and science classes in Andover. And we're kind of part of, like, the Andover group. And so I wound up doing that. And it's funny, I met a woman who I met, who I'm going to college with. I actually just saw her last weekend. And I was like, this was 25 years ago. We met this summer.
Wow. So what kind of stuff happened at the Andover?
So in Andover, it was just, I mean, it was so much fun. It was like a summer program. And I had been away from home before, but it was cool because I learned how to play spades. And you're seeing, like, different people from around the country. So you're asking questions. You're just seeing all kinds of different parts of, I would say, because it was so, it was underrepresented minority. So it was Black, Latino, and Native American. And that was definitely my first introduction to, like, Native American culture. Like, they would do, we would have, like, shows and, like, talent shows where people would show. And so, like, you know, my first hearing a true Native drum circle, right? So hearing that and seeing that and understanding that. And then at the same time, literally in the same show, we would have, like, a little mini gospel concert. Like, it's, the when I think about how, like, we were, like, 14 and 15 doing these things, like, that people today just don't even experience, you know, like, of having, going from, like, a gospel concert to a Native drum circle to, like, a full, you know, salsa dance literally in the same show.
Wow. Yeah.
And so that was really cool, but the, I think the most kind of defining characteristic of it is in your third summer, because you go the summer after, we work backwards. So you, I went the summer before 12th grade, the summer before 11th, and the summer before 10th. But in your last year, you do college counseling. And so they make you sit down and think about college, not from this, I'm going to chase, like, I'm going to chase, you know, the best school. It's thinking about what size school do you want. And I knew I didn't want something super big, but I want something larger. You know, do you want to be city? Do you want to be rural? Like, asking these kind of, like, real introspective questions.
Yeah.
And then every Wednesday, we would go on different college tours. And so we went to, because it was in Massachusetts, so I was someplace close. So we went to Brown, went to RISD, we went to MIT, we went to Boston College, we went to
This was
Harvard.
All through the Andover program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, gosh, what an awesome.
And so we,
introduction to things.
Our longest trip, we wound up going to Dartmouth. Which at the time was the most wired school in the country by Yahoo for like 3 years in a row. So that's, you know, dating myself very much right there. And I thought I was going to major in engineering and go to med school.
Wow. So yeah. So before, when being a child and being like, I don't know, I love to read, but we'll see what's out there. And then the experiences at Andover to doing engineering.
Because I still love science. I still love, like, I loved biology. I loved chemistry. I loved physics. Well, not really physics is always interesting, like, but like chemistry and biology, loved it, right? So I was like, well, I don't know what else to do. I don't know what else is out there. But like, maybe I'll just go be a doctor. And yeah, that sounds cool. And engineering sounds really cool. And so Dartmouth kind of hit all my check boxes. And so I actually applied early decision because I said, I don't want to go anywhere else but. And if I go there, great. And if I don't get in, then I still have time to apply to other schools.
Yeah.
So I wound up applying, wound up getting in. And so I also wanted to be someplace far enough away from my parents where they couldn't just pop up. Like, Dartmouth, you have to make a plan to go to Hanover. Like, you cannot just be like, we're driving to Hanover.
Why was it that you wanted that separation for yourself?
I think I just wanted to really be fully alone. And so I think part of being an only child is your parents just are like, my child. And so I really wanted to be able to create some distance and some kind of process between, like, kind of be my own person.
Yeah.
And so went to Dartmouth, did not major in engineering. And so wound up realizing that while I like the pursuit and the study of, like, you know, math and science and those things, it wasn't going to be enough, like, because there were other people going to med school, so I saw them, I talked to them, and it was like, the real question comes, like, do you want to sit through and fight through organic chemistry? And how much of that really do you really want to do? And are you really excited by that? And the answer to that was no.
Right. What did get you excited?
And so I got excited. I was actually wound up being a social psychology major.
Awesome.
And a theater minor. And so
please open up the doors to how that happened. That sounds
so
amazing.
I have always, as a kid at Hearst, we did a lot of like plays. We did a play a year. I mean, and we were doing like plays like Annie Get Your Gun and like Oliver Twist. Like, we weren't like that. I think about these things, and we were doing like,
this was at your high school.
This was at my elementary school.
My elementary school.
And we were doing, like, we had Christmas programs, and, like, you know, they included songs about Christmas and Kwanzaa and you know, Hanukkah, and, like, you know, all these songs, right? And so I'd always kind of been a little bit of a performer, and so not so much in high school, but in college, I joined the Black Underground Theater group, and I just liked plays, and so it wound up being basically, to do a minor, I just needed like two more classes. And so I actually tell people, if they're still in college, to take an acting class, because that class, you know, my ability to present and how I'm comfortable and how I can stand on stage and how I can talk to people and how I know how to use my voice and all of those things of presence and place and all of that, you either get that through doing Toastmasters or you get that through acting or like other performance, right? Yeah. But with acting, you get the voice component as well. And so I actually wound up taking like all of the acting classes and then doing a lot of studying with, you know, some of the drama classes. And so did both black playwright. And so the highlight of that for me was August Wilson actually came and was a resident, like they call them Montgomery Fellows. Mm-hmm. Bill was a resident at Dartmouth for a semester, and so we actually did one of his plays, and so I was in one of his plays.
Wow.
And
what was that like with him being a part of all that?
It's scary, and he was also really an introvert, and so he was really quiet, and the how things come full circle, so I kind of deviate a little bit. So I did that play, it must have been fall, maybe, I believe, and I did that play. The gentleman who played my husband was actually on exchange term from Morehouse. He went on to become an actor. He's actually famous.
Whoa.
And he was actually on Broadway in an August Wilson play, Jitney, and so I went to see it, and I stayed after, and hadn't seen him in 20 years. But he remembered me.
Awesome. Who is this person?
Brandon Dearden. So he's been on, I guess, The Americans. Because I don't have cable, so like a lot of, I get some pop culture, but he's been on The Americans.
Wow.
He was on The Get Down. He was on, like, I was reading his whole history. And so he's been, like, a working, and he talked about that, right? So, but it was funny because that happened right after I saw, I went to see, so I am a donor to the New Museum, which actually reminds me, we should call them. And so I went to see Fences at a screening at the new African American Museum of African American Culture and History. And they had a panel discussion afterwards with like all of the actors in the movie. And then they had August Wilson's widow.
Wow.
And so I went up to her because it had really been almost 20 years. And she was saying how her daughter was 19. And at the time, her daughter was just a baby. Because we had this whole moment where he, August Wilson, was talking about how he was writing for his daughter. And so I was like, I don't know if you remember me, but I remember, because his wife was with him at the time.
Up in Dartmouth.
Up in Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so I was in Hanover, like your time in Hanover, I was there. And she was like, I remember your face. And so we had a moment. And then after that, afterwards, I saw Brandon. So it was like this full circle completion. Wow. Of doing that. So I went to Dartmouth. And
oh, I love that story.
Yeah, it was so awesome. And it was... what was crazy about that story too is my cousin's actually a famous actor, and that's another story, but somehow it got to my cousin, and Brandon was like, oh, I'm such a fan of your cousin, and my cousin had seen him in Jitney and was like, no, he's amazing, he carried the place. I sent like Brandon like a screenshot. I was like, this is from my cousin, like, he loves you, he's a fan of yours. But yeah, so I went to Dartmouth, I majored in psychology, I did theater, so we did a lot of different works. Black Underground Theater, we did everything from, like, I actually still write poetry, and so I started actually trying to perform it again, but then...
To perform your poetry?
Mm-hmm. I haven't performed it in college, and random since college, and randomly I was out at a jazz club, and they had open word, and I was like, all right, I'm going to do this, and it was horrible, but it was fine.
Horrible because it was crazy being on stage. Or
no, just it was like trying to do it, and I wasn't prepared, and I was trying to do it because it was like jazz musicians, so it was like trying to figure out what to read and have it right, and just it was fine. Because you just have to kind of break the ice as well, and so wound up doing that. All of my internships had been kind of, after I decided I wasn't going to be a doctor, had been kind of communications based, because that's kind of what I knew, just having done so much work, you know, both with my mother, mm-hmm. on campaigns, on various kind of events and things like that.
And your father is a writer, your mother's working in journalism and PR, and that's
both my parents at various points have been writers, and my dad still is a writer. My mom, like, now writes press releases, which I guess counts. And so went to work for a traditional PR firm.
Was this different internship you're mentioning?
No, for after college. Oh, okay. So I graduated from college.
Well, before we jump to graduating, can you tell me about how you made this transition from engineering and medicine? The theater, I think I can understand. You were already working there, and it was a passion. The major in psychology, what was the impetus
for that? I just
took
psychology, and I thought it was really super interesting.
What was it about it that drew you in?
I think understanding people, and I think the first, like, really, because in Psych 101 you cover a little bit everything, and I think I became really fascinated with abnormal psychology, and then also social psych, and so thinking about things like why do good people do bad things, like group psychology and group think. And I wound up, which actually wound up helping me, I wound up even taking a course on, like, business and psychology and organizational development and kind of thinking through what those things meant. And it was just always interesting to me. But I knew I never wanted to be a researcher.
Yeah.
Right?
Tell me a little bit about, I'm wondering two things. One is the relationship between your psychology classes and interests and how that plays out when you're taking on these characters as an actor. Was there a connection between this? And I'm trying to understand people.
I would like to say yes, but not really.
Yeah?
Because it was, I think it just, I never did enough, like, it was more, acting's more of a hobby, and was more of a hobby, than kind of this full-time, like, I'm going to embody characters and, like, do different things, and, like, where I kind of need to always draw into that. And so even the characters, like, reading your own work is really just about voice. Right, and it's trying to give credence to your voice and what you want. Reading and doing other people's work a lot of times there's directors with visions, and so you're just really kind of embodying what they want, and you're putting your own self into it. But it's also kind of like you have an external force that kind of has a vision in mind, and you're working with other people, and so it's partially just relating to them as well. So mm-hmm. I like to say yes, but the answer is really no.
What about the ways that the taking the psychology classes and just the experience of college self changed your sense of self about who you were and what you were about, what you were interested in?
I think being, 18, 19, 20, I didn't really fully understand who I was and couldn't articulate it. And I think that's true of most people in college.
Yes.
And I think one of the things and the challenges, and you see it now, and I always say this when I go back and I talk to the Black students at Dartmouth, is Dartmouth and schools like it are the perfect intersection of class, privilege, race, gender, all of these kinds of things. And so when you keep asking questions like, why do every 4 to 5 years we keep having a party that's always a problem? And it really is because you have groups of people who, Dartmouth actually, I was reading the alumni magazine this morning, and so out of the people from the 1%, Dartmouth actually is the highest percentage out of the IBs of people from the top 1%.
Wow.
Right? And so you think about what that means in terms of access, exposure, what I was talking about. And so you have people coming to Dartmouth who they've never met people who are poor, mm-hmm. right? They've never met people who, I had classmates, I worked in the cafeteria, and I had classmates who would kind of be, I could tell they were embarrassed about seeing me serve them mm-hmm. because I'm working. And for them, they don't have to think about work, right? It's like, it makes it very real to think about things like money and process.
Yeah, and they've never had to struggle like that.
And they've never had to struggle, and nor have they even questioned it within themselves, right? And so you have places like we actually did a play, and it was an interactive play, and it was based on, people talk about why do all the Black kids sit together in a cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And so we did a play, we set it up in one of the theaters where we had all the white people come and sit down and say, what you don't notice is all the football players are sitting together, all the hockey players are sitting together, all the tryouts are sitting together. We just stand out because we look different. Mm-hmm. But it's not a segregation on, it's racist. That's my only time to see that particular group of people, and everybody else in the cafeteria is doing it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, when they thought about that, it's like, walk in and think about how many people you see that are the whole football team sitting together.
Yeah.
And then they started noticing that and thinking about that. But it's because we look different that we stand out to you mm-hmm. versus you're not observing everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm.
So after college, what was it that you did next? Where did you find yourself going?
So after college, did communications. I went to New York.
So after college was that internship in communications?
It was a full-time job.
Oh, okay. And
so
that
was full-time
in
job.
New York?
I had done various internships, different places. I did the congressional internship. I had done an internship at a very small communications firm. Mm. I had done some things through inroads and just kind of different things. And so I went to work for a traditional PR company based in New York. I was actually living in Jersey. Commuting back and forth, and so I was in New York for a while. Realized in that job 6 months in that I hated it.
Well, what? Why?
It was just boring, and I was pitching to media, and I kind of didn't care, and I was just like, whatevs. And it wasn't just that, actually, what I realized, because I was like, stay with your job, and I was like, well, do I want my boss's job? And so because then I knew I had something to look forward to, right?
Yeah.
I was like, all right, I could put up with this if I really wanted her job, but I didn't want her job.
Yeah.
And at that point...
Well, why are you in it?
Why am I in it?
Yeah.
So I wound up quitting after 6 months and going to work for a online brokerage firm, which was then Daytech Online, which doesn't exist anymore. And this was in 2000, so this was right before the market hit, the tech boom mm-hmm. hit its peak. So wound up making more money. I was working. What was really interesting about that was I was working the overnight shift. Hmm. And I was working this crazy shift.
What were you doing there?
I was doing customer service. Mm. And so it was 40 people on the team, 3 women.
Wow.
So it was really, that was really, really learning a lot about men. And it was like, I don't want to say stereotypical Staten Island, Brooklyn. Like, I know people hated the Jersey Shore and was like, they all suck. And like, why are they promoting people? But I was like, I met a lot of people like that.
From the TV show that were your coworkers.
That were my coworkers. Like, especially the men, because like Italian men don't leave their houses. So they were all like 25, 26, making good money, living in their mama's basement. Like,
wow.
Because it's just, that's culturally just what, and they all went to the gym, they all tanned, they all went down to the shore. I was like, you may not like it, but.
There's that reputation of the tech industry of just being such a patriarchal space.
It was. Like, the only time, so very few things offend me, and I actually had to report this guy who was technically here. Is a gray area because I was licensed and he wasn't, so he couldn't technically legally be my boss because he was supposed to have a license above me and he still didn't have a license. So I was like, he can't be my boss. But I was like, he's looking at naked Latina women on the computer behind me, and like, it's not even offensive that he's doing it. It's more so that he doesn't recognize that this is a problem, right? Like, he should at least be on a, like, this was really before smartphones. So it was like, dude, you can't do that.
That's not okay. Yeah.
Like, you just can't do that at work. And so that was kind of the only thing. But you just, I mean, it just, you just become, you know, and so it was interesting there. That's kind of where I actually found a memo. And that's where I realized I've always been a problem solver. So, like, 3 months into the job, I wrote, like, a 16-point memo about how we can improve, like, areas we can improve customer service and the team and this, that, and the other. And so wrote all these suggestions. And was going to send it to the senior VP of like customer service, and like I asked my boss to sign the memo, and he like totally freaked out. He was like, "You can't send this," and I was like, "Dude, what's he going to do? Fire me?"
Right, for helping, for trying to make things better.
But so what they wound up doing was they wound up having me work, because I was actually either always number one or number two for like being rep, like on the rep. So I had a lot of time, especially like 4 o'clock in the morning, it's totally dead. So they wound up basically giving me, like having me work with like the customer experience team as kind of like an outlet and channel. And then because I had passed the test that that guy didn't, I don't know if he ever passed it technically. They had me like lead classes and stuff on the test because I passed it with like 93%. It's a series 7. Mm. Like, I passed with like 93%. So they were like, can you help the rest of the team pass it and stuff like that? And so did that for a while, and the market started declining. And so
this was around just after 2000?
This was 2000. So the market peaked in March of 2000, and then it hit its decline after that. And so around 2001, I had been in the job for more than a year, and I was like, well, I don't want to do customer service anymore. Mm-hmm. And like, I was trying to actually switch to this team I had been supporting, but they had a hiring freeze, and they were like, well, we can't hire you. And I was like, well, why am I kind of doing all this extra work, but I'm not really getting paid for it? And it's like, cool work, but at some point, like, we got to figure something out.
Yeah.
And so it actually wound up happening, and this is one of the things, like, I still am very much a believer in God, and I, like, one weekend, it was just, like, I was just tired of her. I was like, I'm gonna quit, and my mother was like, don't quit, like, just wait, and that was, like, on a Friday, and, like, Monday, they announced packages, and they were like,
wow.
So I was like, okay, now I can get paid to quit, yay. And so got paid to quit.
That one feels like it's meant to be, huh?
It's always meant to be. So got paid to quit. So quit. I obviously took a package. Wound up joining a temp company. And I actually temped at a company that was a startup. And they do receivables. So I was like kind of like a little bit of admin, researcher, kind of like probably program assistant was probably, because they didn't really need an admin, because they kind of had an admin person, like people sponsored. The company actually still exists. They actually still do receivables. But they were like heavy finance guys. And so temped there, which is actually really cool. But and they were like, you can stay, we'll make you permanent. And I was like, I don't really want to stay. I don't really want to do finance.
Yeah.
It's super, make sure everybody gets me. We're good on time.
What was it that you didn't like about it?
It's super detailed. It's like, I'm a strategist. I'm not like an engaging, like be way down in the weeds kind of person. Mm-hmm. And doing finance and building models, like my database manager, she loves that, right? She loves like digging into the weeds. Like it drives me insane. And so just doing that, I just knew it just wasn't like they were cool. And had I stayed, I probably could have made a ton of money, you know, now that I don't think they've gone public, but just, you know, it had been like literally they had started like 2 months before I came on, right?
Wow.
And so wound up joining the Bank of New York, which wanted somebody who asked a lot of questions in their stock transfer department. So they actually wanted somebody who asked a lot of questions but didn't have an accounting background, right? And I knew stocks because of my licenses and things like that. So I wound up joining them, and they were doing like very traditional financial management. So like back office, accounting, you know, they were still processing journal entries on paper that you had to send to like a central location to get everything done.
Wow.
And so I was doing like journal entries and financial management and like helping with billing and all these kind of interesting things. And eventually I got bored there too. And so what they wound up doing, so two things that are really cool about that. I loved my teammates, right? We would throw, and we all loved each other. Like we would literally throw, I worked with a woman, an Italian woman from Staten Island, was probably in her 50s, worked with a man who, another Italian man, definitely in his 50s, worked with a woman who was then 81, an Italian woman who worked, she had worked, Bank of New York had acquired a company, so she worked for the same company for the last 47 years.
Wow.
From Italy, you know, or her family's from Italy, worked with like a German guy who was like probably in his early 60s, he was gonna retire. And we would just, and this other woman who was from Trinidad.
How did this, right? This international mix, just, like your, like your elementary
New York,
school?
And me, and I was young, like 20, how old it was, like to like 24, 25. And then we would go out and like, I would get smashed, and we would all, and, but they would, like, they loved me, and so they would, like, make sure I got home in a cab, and, like, the whole thing, right? We would just go, I mean, we would throw parties where we would be, like, I would bake, because I still bake. They would, like, the other one would bring in, like, chicken parm or lasagna. The men always forgot their assignment, so we started giving them stuff that they could pick up downstairs in the store downstairs. Like, here, sodas and fruit. Like, that's what you're...
Go down the stairs and get them.
And it would literally just be, we haven't had a party for a while. Let's have one tomorrow. And so we all loved each other.
Aww.
But from the actual work I was doing, it was not engaging under any circumstances.
That, like, seems to be a common theme, that you dive into something, once you figure it out, there's just no challenge there, and so it's time to move on.
Well, so I actually stayed because they can figure out things for me to do. So I wound up doing this. They wound up putting me on this committee that was being run by the CEO. That was called Client First, where every department was tasked with forming a committee that looked at, improvements and cost savings and things like that to help productivity, right? So that was kind of really run where we collected suggestions from everybody in our department. And then we implemented them. Like, we kind of weighed them against resources and time, and we implemented them. And the reason why is my boss's boss, who at one point was running a division for BNY, and I should send him a note, I haven't reached out to him in a while, but he was like senior vice president of like back end processing. He wound up kind of going through the bank, knew, like, he was like, you're bored, go do this, right? And knew I had the time, ways to do this. So I did that. And so that was super cool. It kind of kept me engaged and interesting. And then at one point I thought I was going to go to law school, right? Because friends do matter. So the number one like thing that Dartmouth graduates do is go to law school, kind of not immediately after, but for some point in time. So a bunch of my friends were applying to law school. So I was like, well, I should apply to law school. I was like, I'll do securities law. It'll be super cool and it's super fun. And so I did the whole thing. I took the LSAT. I applied to law schools, but one of the things I did, which I actually do tell and I'll talk about my clients, is I did a lot of like soul searching. So I did a lot of work around out talking to people in law school, not in law school, current practicing lawyers, former practicing lawyers, people who just, you know, kind of had various career paths mm-hmm. and really trying to figure out, okay, do I really want to be a lawyer? And wound up kind of coming to the answer, no. Like, this is, like, law school would get me to the job prior to the job I would want. It wouldn't get me to the job I would want. And I said, okay, really, what are you interested in? So we went back to kind of the psychology. And, you know, by then I was kind of reading, like, industrial organizational psych journals, like, just random articles here and there. And so I said,
what was it about? Why? Why were you reading?
Because I recognized that Bank of New York, like, for example, at the time, I don't know how they are now, but they didn't have any program for me, right? And they didn't have, like, so I got to take, because my boss didn't want me to take accounting and finance, so they paid for me to take, like, accounting and finance courses, but there was no program that they could throw me in. There was no leadership development program. There was no, like, oh, we're going to move you. We recognize you're talented, so we're just going to assign, like, an executive to you and move you through the bank and kind of keep you at the bank, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And somebody, you know, pretty senior, quite frankly, told me, was like, you'd be better off quitting and then coming back and moving that way than you would to stay in the bank. And so I was fascinated by this kind of lack of, again, I was already a problem solver. Mm-hmm. And the reason I was on the committee was because I was a problem solver. Mm-hmm. Right? And so my boss, that mentor at the time, was getting an executive MBA from Columbia. And so just talking to him about like the projects he was working on, I was like, oh, this sounds really cool. And so I started thinking about doing like a master's in IO psych. And I was like, well, you kind of have the psych background. I was looking at the classes. He was like, what you really need is the business background. You really need to kind of understand business. And a little bit, like I said, taking a couple of, you know, econ and accounting. So I kind of understood my debits and credits. But so I was like, okay. And so I started looking into business schools. Mm. And that's how I wound up going into, you know, schools still do, but they had, you know, went to info sessions at like NYU and like different schools and different programs. And
knew
like
you wanted to stay in New York though.
I did not.
Oh.
I knew I did not.
Oh, you did not.
I did not. I went to NYU because it was there, because it was convenient.
Yeah. Can you tell me, the career path is fascinating, but the place is also interesting. I mean, New York is a unique animal. What was life like there for you?
So I think in New York, like, there's a point of where you start to block out people because you just have to, because there's so many people and so much coming at you and so much stimulation. So it's super fun. But I also think at the time, you know, if I compare my sense of self now compared to my sense of self then, probably is better. I was not the person I am now then, right? Probably would have just caused havoc all over the city.
Why? What do you mean by that?
Just because I think being sure of yourself and being in New York, like, it creates different opportunities and it creates, like, I remember I was standing, like, taking a train somewhere, and a man came up to me. He was like, you should be in a music video. And I was like, what? And it actually turned out that he actually was somebody who could have made that happen. But I was just like, you know, I'm definitely an ambivert, but I was way shyer. So it's just like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, go away. And so just thinking about, whereas now I'd be like, sure, let's sign up. We're going there today. Like, yeah. Do I need a passport? Like, what's going on? Although I wouldn't be in music videos today. They're horrible. But so I think just being in a place, sense of self, you know, like, I had my group of friends. Mm-hmm. I joined a historically black sorority. Mm-hmm. And so the difference in that is, like, you're always a member for life. So I was doing a lot of volunteering and work with my sorority and meeting, you know, women there through mm-hmm. that, which was a lot of fun and, like, very worthwhile. And just so, but it wasn't, like, it was expensive and it still just felt like a lot. And so at the time mm-hmm. I was just like, I don't want to kind of live here. And I was like, it'd be too much to raise kids here, kind of my mm-hmm. process. And my thinking now that I'm more than, you know, 13 years from that time frame is a little bit different. Like, now when I go back to New York, like, it's much more manageable. I don't know if I would go back. It would take a lot of money for me to go back, mm-hmm. just given, again, how expensive it is and how you know, if you're not getting set up there, it's very hard to be set up there. But I still have a lot of friends and, you know,
so
folks there.
I mean, it is the major city in America, and it's especially in the Northeast Coast. And you grew up in D.C., but you went to school in this very remote place. So can you tell me a little bit about what city versus kind of a more rural or even suburban kind of feel? What is it about either that you liked or didn't?
I like both, right? So I think one of the things, I am a Libra, so I think having that balance. And I like both. Like, I still love New Hampshire for its peace and its beauty. Like, when you go, it's you're there, and you can just be, and you can just exist, and you can just exist on a field with mountains and stars and just breeze, and there's nothing else, and there's no sound, and there's, you know, there's a sense of having other people's energies and having that process, and you don't have to kind of have that.
Did you have experiences like that? I mean, Rock Creek Park is such a huge part of DC's.
It is, but it's not quite the same because you don't get that unfiltered light. Like, it's still, you still have light pollution, and you still kind of have, and you can't really just go to Rock Creek Park at night.
Yeah.
And just be out. Like, Dartmouth is such, not so much now, which is interesting, but Dartmouth, especially back then, I mean, you could be in the green at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's quiet, and it's dark, and it's, you know, and that's just on the green. Like, you're not even, you know, off campus at that point. And so, you can't really do that at night, and it's very hard because you still have to kind of drive and kind of be there. But I think cities are, you know, like, I'll always want to live in a city because I like the ability to go back and forth, but I like the ability to do things like go to Target and, like, you know, like, I have a car, but I like the ability to just go somewhere, have drinks, and, like, you know, get a variety of experiences, which you don't necessarily get as much being in the middle of, you know, in the Upper Valley, right? Yeah. I mean, you definitely have much more experience than you have. I've been to more rural places, and so I think they're, you know, they've developed a community, and even when I go back, like, there's always something new and always something different. And so I enjoy my time being up there, and I enjoy my time engaging in people in that sense, in that way, but I also enjoy being back in the city. And so, so from that standpoint, I think it's, yeah, I think it's great. I'm sorry, one second.
Yeah, please.
I need to make sure before he leaves, he gets...
Well, let's just put a pause here as soon as I get to the point to take a break. All right. So take me to the point where you're thinking of MBAs and you're in New York that somehow brings you to Philadelphia.
So the shorter version of that is I decided to get go to business school. And I knew I wanted to go to business school, and at the time I thought I was going to be an organizational development consultant. And so being a consultant kind of would get me to that kind of mix of psychology. I would have my business background. I would still be problem solving because I obviously at that point loved to problem solve and go in and fix things. And so wound up applying to various business schools, got in, but looked at where I would have the kind of best professional and personal experience, and that wound up being Tuck. So I wound up going back to Dartmouth. Even though I really wanted to go to someplace else, but I wound up going back to Dartmouth. And so I went to Tuck, loved it, still love it, still am actively involved, and actually starting, you know, restarting an organization for alum, diverse alumni at Tuck, so working on that.
Very cool.
And so I went to Tuck, did organizational development consulting for the summer, and so said I really liked consulting, but I didn't really want to have this focus on organizational development. I really wanted to focus on the broader, because I kept having all these questions about different parts of the business and kind of organization development. You're focused on kind of one part. And so I wound up saying, okay, I knew I definitely wanted to be a consultant. And so I wound up graduating from Tuck and joining Deloitte. And
why did you know you wanted to do consulting?
Because I love the problem solving, right? I love asking all the questions. I love digging in and finding all the questions, which was my expectation when I went in. And I talked to people in consulting and kind of said, why are you in consulting and what do you do? And they, you know, I love that they would say, like, no 2 days are the same. And, you know, you kind of go into different companies. And so, obviously, as you picked up on, I need stimulation. And so I don't want to be bored. And so with consulting, there's no 2 days the same. Even if you're doing the same project, it is never the same at different clients because of different locations, different politics, all these kinds of different things. But one of the things that, so TUP has, they call it something different now, but it's essentially you do a global consulting project for a real company. Mm-hmm. And so you spend 3 weeks on site somewhere internationally.
Wow.
And my project, we spent 3 weeks in Puerto Rico, which technically is the U.S., but
yeah.
Our project was looking at a market entry decision in the Caribbean. And so as part of that, we had to look at electricity use across the region in Central America. And I was fascinated by how differences in prices, differences in generation, differences like Costa Rica, I don't know what they're paying now, but it's still probably 90%+ hydro, mm-hmm. versus Jamaica, which is a huge, still today is running mostly off diesel generators, right? Huh. And so you're thinking about the difference in that. So I said, you know what, I'm really interested in energy. So I went to Deloitte, the partner that recruited me happened to be an energy partner.
Uh-huh.
And so I did my first project in Washington, D.C. at Pepco, uh-huh. Which is their regional utility.
Did you, I want to go back to this, the market entry opportunity that you had this internship in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Was that the first real entrance you had to the world of energy?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first experience. What was the actual project? What was the
project was should the company enter the Caribbean market
in terms of energy production?
In terms of energy, so they were a liquid propane company, and so could they enter with either propane tanks or what have you? Because most of their market came from people cold weather, and so places where people were using propane for heating.
Mm-hmm.
Where obviously in the Caribbean, there's nobody using it for heating.
Right.
And so, what are the other opportunities either for emergency electricity generation or industrial use? And so we were looking at it from that perspective.
Had you thought about energy in your own life growing up in New York or how you get around, anything like that? Hadn't really been a factor, no?
I had no idea.
Huh.
Right, no idea. Just, I knew I turned on the lights and they were there.
Yeah.
And I knew, well, at the time I didn't really have a car. I mean, I drove, but like, I had a car in high school for like a few months, but yeah, didn't think about it, right? So there's gas and there's electricity.
So where was the Deloitte, when you got hired by them, where was that based out of?
I went back to D.C. because mm-hmm. I said in D.C., I had lived there since really before college because I spent like a couple of internships there, but I was mostly off, mm-hmm. right? And then I was in New York and New Jersey, and so went back to D.C. and because it didn't matter because you were going to be on the road all the time anyway. And Deloitte actually has their main energy offices are Houston and D.C., or Houston McLean, because it's technically McLean. And so it wound up being a nice fit, right, because I could be in McLean, still working energy, kind of being surrounded by energy partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so wound up going back there and did kind of traditional on-the-ground consulting for 5 years. So
when did you start in the Deloitte position?
2006.
Okay.
Yeah, so right after I graduated from school. Had that summer off and then started right after Labor Day, which is pretty typical of most firms. Some firms now are doing staggering starts, so people want to take off longer, and it allows them to kind of incorporate people a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so did that, you know, loved it, but just got a little bit tired of being on the road, and so was given the opportunity to work internally for them for 2 years. And, you know, said, hey, this is great. You know, I was working in your National Power and Utilities office, supporting a bunch of different partners, doing a bunch of different cool things, which are still relevant. Like, I was having a meeting. I wrote, led the team that wrote 2 white papers on EV. And yesterday I was meeting with some folks about EV. And so the things we were thinking about 5 years ago are now
electric vehicles.
Are now like kind of come. People are asking these questions now. And like we were asking those questions 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so wound up leaving Deloitte for a variety of different reasons. And so part of was I was at the time definitely in an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And so it was just kind of leaving that. Even though I liked what I did at Deloitte, I kind of just needed to take a total break.
Full break, yeah.
From everything. And so, you know, loved the team, loved the work I was doing, but just was like, all right, we're out. So when I'm joining IBM, doing back to the traditional consulting. They were trying to rebuild their kind of utilities practice. And so I was like, I'll go back on the road. I haven't been on the road for a while. It was fine. IBM is a really interesting company.
Where was home? Where
still DC.
Still home.
It doesn't, because you're on the road. It doesn't matter. And IBM has no office culture. Like Deloitte, you actually usually come in on Fridays. There's trainings, there's lunches, there's happy hours, there's meet this person, meet that person. IBM has none of that. So the only time I actually even went into my IBM office was because there was a women's event that IBM was sponsoring that was not IBM, just they happened to sponsor, and it was held at the office. So I was like, oh, I'll just work from the office, and then I don't have to fight to come into the city at rush hour. I'll already just be there. And even then, like, trying to do that, like, Deloitte was very easy. Like, I could go to any, I could go online, make bookings, book a desk in any Deloitte office anywhere in the world. Huh. Super easy. IBM, like, I showed up, like, nothing worked. It was a mess. But they're not set up for that model, which is interesting, because now they're saying you have to live within, like, 50 miles of an IBM office. Like, they just made that announcement. And people are just saying it's just a back end to kind of get people to be fired, to quit without them having to do layoffs.
Interesting.
So worked for IBM, which was...
Still doing the energy consulting.
Mm-hmm. And so loved my team.
How were the projects different?
IBM is not as strategic, so I wound up leading a team of 19 developers doing very technical stuff, which I'm not a technical person. I learned a lot. Like, I am smart, and I'm quick pick up on things. So I wound up being able to sit in meetings with, like, enterprise architects and technical architects and questioning them and offering my input. But that's not what I want to do, nor was it something that is in my strong suit, mm-hmm. right? So despite as I look on my screen, I'm teaching myself HTML5, because I'm building a website, but also we're redeveloping our website, so I just want to know what questions to ask. Mm-hmm. So it's actually useful to be able to think about, like, I don't want to build websites, I just want to know what questions to ask. But it was a good experience. It's come in very useful. In any sense, because just, again, understanding technical things, understanding how, you know, code and things are developed. But their projects were, I think the challenge is, and there have been several articles in this, and actually I was meeting with a woman who were like, why hasn't Jenny been fired? Because they lost money every year for, like, the last 5 years, every quarter. And in some of the things they're trying to do, the market's growing, right? And the average tenure of the executive team is something like 30 plus years, right? So if you take that, like, IBM used to make things. And so when you make things, some of the processes and procedures and things actually matter. Mm-hmm. But when you don't make things and you have a professional services team that by definition needs to be flexible, you need to have systems that are flexible. And Deloitte, you know, obviously had those systems, mm-hmm. and IBM didn't. And so it's just interesting to see the difference between the two.
I've heard Steve Jobs talk about the difference between a marketing company and a company that produces and makes things, and how the atrophy of the marketing people, when they get into higher executive positions, the company doesn't grow the way that a builder company does.
But this company needs the opposite, right? They need strategists. They mm-hmm. need people who are not focused on, you know, when IBM was making servers, taking the scent out of the production chain actually does matter, right? It doesn't matter when you're billing that penny to the client. It doesn't matter, right? And if that penny saves me as a consultant, if I spend $20 more or $50 more to take a non-connecting flight, the value of my time and the potential for all of these downstream things is worth way more than that $50, mm. right? Like, taking a non-connecting flight that costs $50 more is way more valuable to both you, the client, my well-being, yeah. me as a company. So I wound up leaving IBM just because I absolutely actually just hated it. I couldn't stand it. And there was some politics going on where it just was not a place where I wanted to be or grow a career. Mm-hmm. And so wound up leaving there, joining a renewable energy company that was based in Bethesda.
Why renewable energy?
Because it was still energy, and it was kind of a newly created role. And so I was able to kind of use and stay in my industry. And so at that point, when I left IBM, before I kind of made the decision, when I was job hunting, I really made a decision. Because at that point, it was like, either you got to stay in energy, or you kind of got to, like, make a switch now. Mm-hmm. And I really said at that point, you know, I have this experience. There's one, not a lot of people of color, not a lot of women. My experience is worth money on the open market. Let's do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So worked with the a renewable energy company based in Bethesda, who's the world's largest producer of industrial pellets. Mm-hmm. And so it was a newly created role. And so they were really looking at how to enter new markets, how to approach things differently. So it's kind of like an internal consulting role.
What are industrial pellets?
So they're pellets. You can actually use wood waste and create a pellet from them. Basically, like if you've seen like a cat pine or like a gerbil pellet, mm-hmm. like an animal pellet, you can actually use that to burn instead of coal. And you get way less of the bad emissions. Even taking the entire life cycle of like trucking and shipping. And you could actually even in the US potentially co-fire with coal and save again. You get less of the SOX, you get less of the NOx, you get less of those bad things. And you're using a, you know, renewable product because it's really wood that's coming from like forest thinnings and like the leftovers from lumber yards. I mean, pretty much anything that's wood you can use. Mm-hmm. You can technically use agricultural waste too, but the agricultural waste, I remember I was at a conference when I was working there talking to like an agri professor from like Austin, Texas A&M. So I had this whole conversation, but agri waste kind of produces different, doesn't produce worse emissions, it does different things within the boiler. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to manage that a little bit differently. But
why in Bethesda would this company exist?
It existed in Bethesda because the founders went to UVA, and the company was actually founded in Richmond. So they were Richmond first. And then they were like, well, we can't really get talent, and kind of just like as we grow the company, we need to move somewhere. And so either the CEO lived in Bethesda or just like they wanted to be outside of DC. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they wound up being in Bethesda.
Yeah.
I forgot the exact reason, but they were like, at some point they had two companies, and so they sold one and then went with this one.
Gotcha.
And so they were like, we need to grow, we're going to need to hire staff, we're going to need to hire, you know, environmentalists and mm-hmm. all of these kind of things that DC has plenty of people who are environmentalists and sustainability and all those folks. And so,
So you worked for them, and then that was your entry point into renewables.
That was, well, yes and no. So I had done some renewables and alternative for big, large utilities, right? And so when I was in energy, I did a little bit of everything because as a consultant, you always have to kind of be a little bit of everything, right? So you are, so I did oil and gas. I did traditional power and generation. I did a little bit of alternatives. Most of the companies, and I did renewables for like large utilities, right? Mm-hmm. So like thinking through like some analysis papers on, you know, what is the renewable market going to look like? Because most utilities are generally in a wait and see. And so at the time, particularly with wind and solar, they were nowhere near as inexpensive as they are now. Mm-hmm. And so they were kind of like, well, we need some. But this was also, you know, with really states, really before, most states have it, but really, they had really aggressive renewable portfolio standards and kind of those things as
gotcha.
Well.
How did you end up coming to Philadelphia and the energy co-op?
So from that standpoint, so I went there. That wound up not working out for several different reasons. I consulted on my own just for like through projects with friends for probably about 10 months. And so I was still looking for a job, but it was being very, very strategic about it. And so I said, I want to stay in energy. I wanted to kind of have somewhere I could go to my experience and not do consulting.
You were done with the consulting at that point.
I was done with the consulting. Just being back on the road, and just, like, it's fun. I mean, I love the work. Like, I love the work I do. But there's kind of, at that point, I'm just like... and so I saw the job, and I posted it. So I was living in D.C., and then they called me back. And here's the interesting thing. So it's right around my birthday. I had walking pneumonia. And
wait, say it again.
I had walking pneumonia.
Oh.
So I was like... They called me in for an interview, and I had to cancel because I was like, I literally am, like...
a zombie, yeah, and I
like,
will.
On antibiotics and on codeine,
oh,
right? Because the doctor, frankly, told me, she was like, there's really... Like, we'll give you the antibiotics, but really, you just need to sleep. So here's like, cough syrup with codeine because you don't want to wake up, like, hacking. So they rescheduled... And I was, like, the last person they interviewed, like, on the very last day. I actually still had a touch of it, so I, like, pulled myself together, like, took the train up here, took the train back, and, like, collapsed for, like, another 2 days. But they hired me.
So did you know anything about what the co-op was?
I looked it up. I had done a lot of research. And being in D.C., which is deregulated, I was very, very familiar with choice and generation. And so what was interesting to me was, one, that this was a nonprofit, and so really understanding kind of what, how they operate in the space as a co-op. And DC does not have nearly as many co-ops as Philly does, mm-hmm. right?
Can you tell me what the, maybe briefly explain what the Energy Co-op is?
So the Energy Co-op is unique in that we are a retail energy cooperative. And so we are nonprofit and member-owned. So our members own... you know, a piece of us, which means if should we ever dissolve, at some point, you know, the members would get whatever's left over from our liabilities and sales of our assets. Most electric, so this is a little bit different. There are about 2,000 plus electric cooperatives in the U.S., but the majority of them, I've only been able to find about half a dozen that are actually retail. So the majority of them are actually serving their customers, our members, in the exact same way that PECO serves us, right? Through generation or through transmission, distribution, and purchasing power on behalf of their members, but not at a wholesale price, right? We are actually purchasing clean power wholesale and then basically reselling it to our members, right? Mm-hmm. So that in the choice, they can get a choice to support clean power.
I see. And because Pennsylvania is one of the few states that you can make that choice of where you're getting energy, even through PECO as a provider, mm-hmm. so they would go through PECO, choose the energy co-op as their provider, and purchase through PECO, purchase what energy co-op offers?
No, so they actually can, they can go to us, come to us, and we would sign up. So we're their generation. And so I actually, at the meeting, you know, did a kind of mini, why do I have to get my bill through PECO? Because even if you join us, you still got to get your bill through PECO. Mm-hmm. And the short version of that is PECO owns, very, very simplistically, the last mile to your house, right? So that electricity has to flow and has to move to your house to actually power your house. Mm-hmm. PECO owns that last mile. And for the reasons I get into in that presentation, that will always be a monopoly. What we are is a generation supplier. So you are allowed to buy, it's just like the same thing with the gas in your car. You own your car, you have to maintain it. Think of PECO as like you as the car, you have to maintain it, you have to change your oil, you have to do all of that. You can buy your gas from anywhere, mm-hmm. right? It's the same thing, is that you can buy, we are a gas station, you know, same on the corner that you want. And you want to buy this gas station because we're brighter, we're lighter, we're cleaner, you know, not we're green, but it's that same kind of concept. And so you can sign up through us directly through us, and we'll let PECO know, but your bill will still come through PECO, and we'll have a line item on it that says charges from the energy co-op.
Gotcha. So when you came to work here, and that was around what time? Like year?
That was November. Of last year.
Oh, okay.
So I've only been here, I guess, almost 8 months now. And so 7 months.
Yeah, that's when you moved to Philadelphia.
So actually, no. So I actually was, some wonderful friends live at 20th and Walnut and have an extra room. And so I was actually going back and forth. So coming here during the week, staying with them, and then going back to D.C. on the weekends. And so trying to figure out where I was going to live and get a feel for the city. And so doing, like, after work, apartment hunting. I wound up moving to a house, but I actually formally moved in January.
Okay.
This year. So found a place in Brewerytown, rented a lovely two-bedroom house, and formally moved in January.
Awesome.
So
tell me about your experience of being in Philadelphia. What's the vibe for the city for you?
So for me, it's just, I think it's been different. Like, I recognize and start to understand how Philadelphia is definitely much more less transient than, like, a New York or a D.C., right? Even from D.C., you know, I think recognizing, like, I meet people who are not from D.C. all the time. And I think in Philly, one of the things I notice is people who are from here either stay here or leave and come back. Mm-hmm. And so I think that creates a really good sense of community and people knowing people and being, knowing who everybody is and kind of where everybody's from and what everybody's doing and kind of where everybody is. And for us, being an organization that's been around since 1979, really means that we're going to have roots here and we're going to be here. And so it hasn't been like a super adjustment. I also think there's kind of like an East Coast aesthetic to cities. And so, you know, for me, the greatest thing, which is awesome, is I can actually just take a bus to work. Like, I don't have to drive. And I can take a bus, which, if traffic has been reasonable, is 30 minutes, you know, pretty much from my door to door. And so, you know, just getting used to, the only thing I think that for me is 76, which is, I think, a problem for everybody, because, like, on
Interstate
the other
76?
Side, yeah, it's the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and I used to have to drive to Cleveland, and most of that's on the Turnpike, and it's just not a fun drive. And so at some point you get past 76 and you're like, oh, 76 is being 76 right now, right? Where it's like mountain and cliff, and you're like, and you know, the next, I remember one year I drove and they were working on all the like service stations. It was like 110 miles before you can get gas, like, get gas now. And like the line was like, you know, everybody getting gas. But you know, for the most part, my adjustment, it's been relatively seamless. Hi, are you leaving?
I'm leaving.
Okay, I'll see you over there.
Okay. Thanks.
It's his wife.
Oh, awesome.
Who's doing the event. Because I have friends here, and so just, you know, meeting new people and, like, groups and kind of getting out. I think the hardest thing has actually been, like, for whatever reason, on weekends, like, either I've had, like, pre-events that have already been planned for a long time in D.C., or New York, because I feel like I'm not getting enough time, you know, in either being here on the weekends. So, like, my goal is to try to be here more weekends, which I think in the fall, like, all of the events and conferences and things like that that I've been going to are all actually in Philly, so I'm like, please come to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Right on.
So.
I'd love to make the transition to thinking about the ideas of the future. Mm-hmm. Would it be better to schedule another time to allow us to move into that?
I was going to say, we probably should at this point.
Yeah.
Now
okay. Well, let me turn this off and we can figure out a time to then to come back and revisit that visioning.
Chatting about.
All right, this is Roger Eardley Pryor. Today is July 27th. This is a second interview with Damali Rhett at the Energy Co-op in Philadelphia. The last time we spoke, Damali, we would covered some of your past history growing up outside D.C., childhood experiences in the summer, and then up to Dartmouth, some of the career you had in consulting, and eventually bringing you here to Philadelphia.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you could, to help us get into the place of Philadelphia, what does living in Philadelphia mean to you? What is it? What has that experience been for you?
I think, quite honestly, I'm still trying to figure that out and define it. One of the things, you know, I recognized very early on is Philadelphia is definitely a city of neighborhoods. But I think when I look at most cities are actually cities of neighborhoods. And, you know, being residents of those cities kind of versus touring them or, you know, you go for a couple of days. And so really trying to adjust, because all of my previous engagement with Philly has really been on a more tourist basis or for conferences. And so really not coming down, you know, to live here and kind of be here for an extended period of time. And so still trying to figure out kind of what does Philly mean, you know, for me and my life. And I think one of the things, though, you know, I love where I live. I live in Brewerytown. I love the house where I'm at. I love, you know, having access to, you know, the highway and being able to walk a lot of places. And so I really know like that about myself. Like, I love walkable cities. I love being able to kind of do things and have easy access to a lot of things that are relatively close. And I think the other thing about Philly, I would say, is it's definitely an accessible city. So meaning coming here, joining organizations, meeting people, really understanding, you know, that brotherly love, like that's something that is taken very seriously here. And so it can be a little, in some sense, I am definitely used to kind of a Southern, like, you know, people waving and saying hi, but it's definitely pushed here where people will just go out their way and sit there and talk to you, you know, for 15 minutes about some things they just saw you on the street, right? Mm-hmm. So
nice. Maybe we can think a little abstractly, since we're moving into a visioneering sort of piece. And I'll just ask you some abstract questions about what are some things in your life that you love most?
The things I love in my life the most, I think the first thing are the people that have been in my life. And so, you know, friends, family, the people that I meet now. It's interesting because I believe in you, when you are intentional, you can manifest things. And even when you're not intentional, you can manifest things. And so I love that about that. I am surrounded by people who are rooted in love, but are rooted in also the development of other people. And so for me personally, I always think of my life's purpose as helping people and empowering people to live their best authentic selves. And what that means to me is giving. Sometimes you're going to have to go against what society tells you, or you're going to have to go against, you know, what you've heard all your life, or you're going to have to kind of step out on fear. Maybe it's taking a new job, maybe it's moving to a new city, but helping people live their authentic lives and not the lives that other people prescribe that they should live.
Beautiful. So, what are some of the things that you fear in life, or just fear in general?
So I think the things that I fear are that I'm not going to fully develop into the person I know I could be tomorrow. Like, I'm content and happy with who I am today, but have some goals and have some things that I am, you know, tomorrow, like, that somehow I'm just not, I'm going to get stuck, because it's very easy to get stuck in our own way for different reasons. And so I think that's probably my greatest fear, is that, and I've seen that happen, you know, personally, where I've seen people who've had this great potential, and for a variety of different reasons. It's interesting, I was actually reading, Lamar Odom wrote a fantastic piece today about his drug addiction, and one of the things he said was, you know, essentially something to the effect, I have to get the exact quote, but essentially something to the effect of, nothing is above anybody, because he would have never thought, you know, he started off his career against drugs, against anything, and, you know, look where he wound up. And I think understanding that is really powerful, that, you know, I'm never going to be too big to say, this will never happen to me. It could happen to you, and it could happen to you relatively quickly.
Hmm. What are some things that most inspire hope in you?
I think the things that inspire hope in me are when I see my helping people be their authentic selves. So watching that transformation, and then also knowing and seeing my own transformation. And so things that, you know, are happening to me, you know, personally, professionally, that I would have never thought, like, even this, like, you know, a year ago, if you asked me, I would have never said, like, oh yeah, this is going to happen. And then it happened, and you're kind of like, oh my God, it's happening. And so seeing that and getting people and also recognizing, I think one of the things we don't do is we don't admit that you can still be excited. Like, you can still, I'm still thrilled to be here, but I'm still also scared. Like, what happens if this whole thing falls apart? But that acknowledging both of that, I think, really is what motivates me and pushes me in saying, you know, I'm excited, I'm here, I have plans, I want to do all these things, but also not saying, like, I don't feel these other things as well. So.
So when you say this, I assume that means here at the Energy
Co-op. The Energy Co-op.
That might be a nice point for us to think about. What do you think of when, what comes to mind whenever the word energy is used? What does energy bring up?
So I think of energy in two different ways. So I think the kind of tactical, physical energy, which supplies and moves things. And then I also think of kind of a spiritual energy. And so from the physical energy, you know, since I've been in the industry, I always break it down into two things, right? Transportation, so the literal kinetic movement of people from place to place, and then kind of power and generation. And so the idea of, you know, using it, which again is literally the movement of electrons in various forms, but moving that to create opportunities for people.
Awesome. Can you tell me a little bit about that other component of energy, the spiritual energy?
So I think the spiritual energy, it's funny, I was talking with somebody last night, and it's the thing about the spiritual energy, and it's becoming, like, I've noticed myself personally that my ability to connect in certain ways with people has gotten stronger as I've gotten more intentional and spent more time inside of myself rather than externally. And it's one of those things where you can feel things, and I'm an empath. And so I'll give you an example. So last night I was like running, I'm going on vacation, so I was like running errands, and a young guy came up to me in the parking lot, and he was explaining to me how he had walked down to Market Street, got his job through a job program, but the job was in Conshohocken, and how he didn't have any money to get out there because we're at like the mall, the little outside retail at like 52nd and Parkside. So obviously we're not out there. And so how, you know, just impacted me of thinking about how we live in a country of excess, but people are still literally begging so that they can get to work. And so what that meant, kind of thinking about the cycles, and that, you know, we assume it's very easy to sit for multiple people to assume, well, friends and family, and you can go here, and that's a gap, right? And so thinking about that, okay, you know, how can we create and transform all of the positivity so that it starts spreading to people, which goes, again, it's all, for me, it's connected, because that goes back to, can you be your authentic self, right? Can you be yourself, who you are? And I like to say, who are you in the dark with no labels, no Facebook, no Twitter, you know, by yourself? Who is that person? And so that's your most authentic self.
And that's the, and when you're in touch with that authentic self, there's a spiritual energy that's moving then, imbalance then,
it's
reaching
moving,
out.
It's moving, it's helping you, it's helping guide you, it's helping push you towards something. And so even while you are wanting something, it helps push you towards something, helps put people in your path. It helps you also recognize when you are talking to people and you see people. You know, you can meet somebody, like, you know, you have that feeling of you met people and you instantly get along. And that's because both of your spiritual energies are talking to each other and exchanging. And so, you know, do you enjoy, I always like to say, the people I invite in my life, I just actively enjoy being around them because they recharge me, they make me feel better. Just sitting there doing nothing, but, you know, literally doing nothing. Maybe we're watching TV, maybe we're in silence, maybe we're just on our phones, but the fact that we're there, we're exchanging that. So
beautiful. How do you get your electricity in terms of the material, physical electricity?
So all electricity's the same. There's no difference. I'm obviously a member of the co-op, so I get I actually have our PA power source. So I get our power sourced from Pennsylvania wind sources and a little bit of solar. But all of the electricity, you know, that's generated is the same. It's not like oil where there's different grades and different additives and things like that they happen, or even when they pump it out the ground, it's usually just sulfur content and how it flows and kind of the technical piece around that. But all energy, all electricity is the same. So
if you could picture a Philadelphia that is increasing its renewable energy use, how do you think that renewable energy use in Philly would improve the quality of people's lives, or their health, even water quality, economic opportunities. How do you see those things coming together?
So I'd say in the future, what I envision for Philadelphia would be really a series of microgrids. And what a microgrid is basically a smaller version of where you create, you know, linked, self-sustaining generation. And that generation likely is going to come from some form of solar and storage, right? So as we're on a day like today, we're way over there, it's, you know, a little bit sunny. If it's not sunny enough, I can use a battery backup. And the impacts, I think, of what that means are, one, you know, you don't have wires, you don't have dangerous situations and storms. In storms, you're actually now using a battery backup, so you're much less likely to have people, you know, losing power or being without power for several days. And those have ripple impacts, because you think of, you know, people's ability to work. You think of fridges going out, and you know, you might, it's not unreasonable to say you'll have several hundred dollars worth of food, you know, if your fridge goes out for a few days, that you just have to toss and throw away. But the big thing for me, I think, for Philly is you'll see an impact to improving the level of poverty access, because I think one of the things with energy, and we've seen this, and we've seen this all over the world, but you would see it even in Philly, is you now have the ability to not just rely on sunlight for reading, right? You have the ability to have a computer and charge it. You have the ability to have a cell phone and charge it at night and be able to use it. You know, you can take classes on your phone now. And so what does that mean for somebody who's looking to, you know, for opportunities, or somebody who's looking for free? You know, and even thinking about, you know, water and access to that. Well, now if you're not maintaining as many lines, maybe you can well, it's different because of the utilities, but, you know, what does that mean from Philadelphia's ability to, maybe PECO winds up getting, you know, to running the water company, right? Because it's very similar things, but they have all this expertise. But I think even then, you know, most people don't realize when your power goes out, after some point, you won't have any water, because all the water meters are electric and the pumps are electric. And so it's not moving. It's not coming to your house. So even thinking about things like that, you know, when you have these big storms, or you're in the middle of winter, or something's happening. So, huh.
You use the term poverty access. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
So one of the things, I didn't even realize this, but when I moved to Philly, just learning, trying to learn more about the city and demographic, is Philly is actually currently the poorest city in the country, and there's the highest level of deep poverty, and it's become generational. And so, like, over, like, in certain neighborhoods, over 25 years, you've had quadruple poverty rates. And so what does that mean, you know, for people who, and it's not just energy, right? It's, you know, it goes back to that sense of spiritual energy of, if you're depressed because you don't have heat, you don't have electricity, you're hungry, your health is poor because you're in areas where, you know, there's trash everywhere, and it's always, you're always cold, what does that mean? So all of these things are related. So it's not just for me, let's figure out how to get people cheap energy that is clean, because that improves, you know, the planet, and not just the planet. The big thing I think people misunderstand about climate change is something like, not that there won't be seasons, it's that the seasons will be much more extremes. And so you're going to wind up having a Sandy, not once every 100 years, but once every 10. And so what does that mean when you're thinking about planning? What does that mean when you're thinking about infrastructure? What does that mean when you're thinking about, oh, I need to shore up these buildings because in 10 years, I don't know when, you know, whereas before it was once every 100. And so that's, for me, is really the impact of, okay, if I'm going to have, you know, a young kid, you know, slightly north of Brewerytown, I'm not actually sure what that neighborhood is called, but slightly north of Brewerytown, you know, so still 20 minutes from Central City, what is that kid going to be able to have access to that he or she can truly believe that they can grow up, you know, live somewhere and be able to develop a life that celebrates their humanity, right? Where they don't have to beg for money to go to work. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
I love it. Let's talk about future visions. We'll go through three scenarios, and these are entirely up to you as to how you want to envision your own future. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, business as usual route. There's the what could we possibly hope for, and then there's also a more utopian visioning. And so however you want to do it is however you want to do it. We'll move through the first one is thinking about the future in about 50 years. Philadelphia in 50 years, energy use, energy production, and what that might look like for a person living in Philadelphia. If you could picture that person, what her or his life is like, where they live, what their day might look like, let's say in 50 years.
So in 50 years, I think things still won't look drastically different. I think what you're going to see is a lot more rooftop solar, so a lot more people doing rooftop solar. Rooftop wind doesn't really look different, but what I think you will start to see, which again, people won't feel different, but you will start to basically see almost all of your electricity being produced by green sources, right? But I think the infrastructure as we have it now, it takes a very long time to kind of dismantle this type of infrastructure, right? But I think you're starting to see within new developments and new growths and new projects, people looking and asking the question of, should we continue doing what we've always done? Or is this now that we're building this new thing, is this really a good opportunity to shift that? So I think you'll find people doing things like distributed generation and microgrid, and it'll be common enough that it's not uncommon, but it won't be, you know, the standard, like everybody's standard is now hooked up to brown power through a grid, you know, decentralized grid. So that's what I think. It won't feel very different. Like if I were 50 years older, it won't feel very different to me. But it will, you'll see a pretty significant change.
Great. Let's think a little bit further and say almost 125 years. Let's just take the year 2140 as a place. Just as a little bit of back reference to think about what that was like 123 years in the past. That was the year 1894 from then. Coca-Cola was first being sold in bottles. Norman Rockwell had just been born. Dancer Martha Graham was just born. Edison had just built the world's first coal-fired power plant. So coal was just at the time beginning to take over the United States as far as the dominant energy source. So in 2140, that'll be almost 125 years from now, what is life like in Philadelphia and what's energy use like?
So I think a couple of things. I think one, we won't have smartphones anymore.
No?
I think the way that we will have them will be some sort of headset or something where it's just, you just wear it all the time and you don't think about it. But I don't think we're going to have like a separate phone. I think it will be connected to kind of computers, but I think it's going to be a lot more controlled with your mind and what, and your thoughts, which is where we're headed towards things like Alexa and Siri. And so I think, you know, physically a lot of the buildings will feel the same, but I think from a people perspective, people will not be able to disconnect, which both, you know, excites me and worries me to some extent. I think at that point, though, from an energy perspective, you'll start to see much more, pretty much everybody by then will be on some sort of microgrid or distributed generation. So I think you'll start to see on every building, probably decorative, but you'll see solar panels on every building that will be highly efficient, so you won't need the level of panels you need now, connected to batteries. Right, I think everything is going to run off of storage, off of energy storage, with backups for like days, like when it was really hot last week, with some industrial kind of backups. Right, I don't think the utility as it exists today will exist tomorrow.
So that's the centralized power system generation won't be there.
I think it won't be there. I think what you're going to see is, in rural areas, like I mentioned, most people think cooperatives and think rural area cooperatives. I think you will still have some semblance of that because they built it and it's very hard for them to get the money
And I think that's where you're going to go out to see, oh, look, you know, here's what we used to have 50 years ago.
So the rural areas will still be connected to that centralized grid?
Well, they create their own, right, lot of times, and they'll buy. But I think that's the vestiges that you'll see, because it's in a city, you get the economies of scale, right? I think so. If you're looking at something like PECO, which has already made itself into a transmission distribution company, I really think you're going to start to look at them, or they're going to start to, if they're smart, want to own those solar panels and maintain them and make their money through the maintaining of them, right? But they won't make it through a rate of on-demand electricity.
Because it'll just be pretty constant.
Or people are just going to pull their batteries, you know, and pull from their batteries.
So climate scientists, given how much carbon has been put into the atmosphere and expectations for more, there's a general belief that Philadelphia itself will suffer some of the impacts of polar ice cap melting, but certainly, as you mentioned, the seasonal extremes, much, much hotter summers, mm-hmm. colder, more intense precipitation in winter, harder precipitation throughout the year when it does fall. So Philly won't have the same kind of impact that, say, Miami or New York will have with the flooding, but some of the rivers are expected to have some flooding. Will Philly in 125 about years, in the year 2140, be a bigger city, a smaller city? What will the population be like?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think you may actually start to see more people moving inwards, particularly up and down from the East Coast, right? Because as people, you know, people say, I don't want to deal with this, I think you're going to start to see an influx in the middle of the country where there's space. It's interesting because they have their own issues, but it's different issues, right? It's their tornadoes and it's the really cold. I think people also don't appreciate how cold the winters are in the middle of the country, like really, really cold. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to start to see more people move out that way. I think the city, you know, boundaries itself will kind of remain the same. But I think from today, it'll definitely be a higher population. Philly will, just through population growth. But I think in 125 years, at some point, they're going to reach a plateau and kind of maintain that plateau versus kind of adding new people, mm-hmm. right? Like at some point, you're going to say, you know, we have X number of million people, and that's just kind of what we have.
Mm. How, if the population gets bigger, if there is going to be that growth, how does, and there is an existing disinvestment and poverty in Philly, how would that relate to the future of Philadelphia, maybe taking on these kind of climate refugees and energy use? How does all that kind of play out in 125 years?
I think the people who move here, the people who move to the cities, and, you know, I like that term, climate refugees, will be a little bit different. And people who live in the city will be able to afford to live in the city, right? I'm not really sure what's, you know, generational poverty has so many issues that you need to address. It's very hard because you really need the blanket wraparound services, right? Like you need a school system that actually helps educate and funds people. And then you actually need to think through that. You take a young child, they enter a school system, you need to feed them, you need to give them heat, you need to give them access to stuff, and you need to just not do stop there. You need to actually expose them and train them for whatever job they have. And that's where, like, the whole Chicago, you know, they have to have these things to graduate from high school. It's very dangerous. Because if you're not willing to provide, like, if you're not willing to say, you know, everybody can go to Community College of Philadelphia for free, that gets, you know, as long as you graduate, we'll let you in. You can't mandate some of these things, right? But then I think you need to think about healthcare, right? You know, that's another big one, is what is the impact, both physical healthcare and mental healthcare, right? Because now you have, part of the challenge that happens is you have kids who think very differently than their parents and who are going to have very different experiences. And that challenge, that's hard, right? Just challenging, because people are people. So we have this expectation, like, parents always want the best for their kids. That's not always the case. And so you have to think about healthcare, and then you have to think about, okay, you know, now you've done the education, and then you think about energy, right? And then you think about, okay, you know, do they just, at its basic for cities, what they really think about, what you're really thinking about, is heat and electricity, right? You know, obviously there's a hugely robust public transportation system here. And so if Philly maintains that, you know, tons of people come here without cars, right? And there's ideas and thoughts about, you know, between Uber and taxis and public transportation, you know, and some of the data's pointed this out, you know, people just won't have cars, right? If they want cars, they'll call an Uber. So it's gonna be weird because you're gonna have this whole section of the population that has cars that are basically providing, that are service cars. Mm-hmm. So really thinking from an energy perspective of electricity and heat, and making sure, again, you know, one of the things that categorizes a public utility is that it's on demand without discrimination. Meaning, you know, when I turn on, regardless of where I live, when I turn, flip the switch, power should, like, I should get electricity, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of where I think, you know, the through process in 125 years, where we'll be. So I don't think we're going to get these, like, kind of climate refugees, because I think they're going to wind up going to places where they can either set something up or that are going to be less expensive, right? Like, you're going to, so I think you're going to see some of that class division.
Mm. So Philly won't be necessarily a space for those refugees because they'll be priced out.
They'll be priced out, but also thinking about opportunities and thinking about, you know, what's going to drive them here. And they'll probably be, quite frankly, the way the East Coast is going, you know, it's hard for people. There's I forget what book it is. There's a shift at where you have, if people can find affordable housing in the city, it actually creates dynamics for the city to collapse. Because what happens is, if you think about all the people who, you know, just your regular workers, right? Like, so everybody who's just in the city has a job, just kind of comes in, goes home, does good work. If they can afford to live in the city and they're pushed further and further out, then they start moving further and further out, and you wind up with this city of highly elite, and I even can see it in DC, right? All these, you know, $2,500 studio apartments. If something happens, well, you have this entire swath of real estate that's just collapsed, right? And you have all these people now that apartment can't go for $2,500, because who's going to rent that, right? And if I'm paying $2,500 and now I see that you're advertising for $2,000, well, I'm going to the next, and it starts to create a cycle where it's just, it becomes a bubble. And mm-hmm. so having the mix of having affordable housing and services really creates, you know, dynamic. It seems counterintuitive, but that's actually how you create thriving, dynamic cities.
Hmm. Pennsylvania sits on an ocean of natural gas, the Marcellus Shale. In 125 years, in around 2140, will that ocean of gas be a part of Philadelphia's energy scene in the future? Or will it be the renewables?
I think to some extent, yes. But I, because of the access of renewables, you know, I can literally throw some solar panels and a battery in somebody's house, and they're, aside from, you know, regular maintenance and things like that, they're fine, right? Then I don't have the infrastructure problem. I think what you'll see is natural gas really pushed for industrial use. For sure, because they're just such large consumers. Although I think you'll start to see more and more methane and things used as well. And then I also think you'll see it again, that also creates solution and infrastructure for rural areas and for people who are not in the city or not on, you know, not able to access like a microgrid, right? You can actually, you know, fairly easily set up, you know, natural gas and do some things with it.
So it'll still be part of the scene, but just not maybe as much.
Natural gas will be where heating oil is now, right? It's declining. It happens. It's still there. Because I also think Pennsylvania sits on a great natural gas deposit, but it also sits on great forest, right? It also sits, which you can do forest thinnings. Like, there's so many ways to maintain and actually grow forest that you can then use that for energy, right? So we're forgetting of... you know, hydropower, right? I haven't talked about it because we're more focused on residential, but obviously you will still have wind power and things that you can do from wind. You can still use biomass, right, which is renewable. You can, in theory, just grow a bunch of switchgrass, you know, dry it out, pellet it up, and throw it in a burner, and then you're creating. If we still have steam, right, if we still have steam engines to create electricity, right, so...
So another thing you mentioned when thinking about the material of energy, when you think about it, transportation is a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
In this Philadelphia of 2140, when people, there's these service cars around or the public infrastructure, is that all solar powered? How are people powered? How is the movement of transportation being powered?
I think it's going to move back to biodiesel, so using pure oils and waste. Because I think that where society overall is going to move to is to start to really understand. I think one of the things we really don't focus on is the impact of waste and trying to throw things out and trying to reuse things and how much we have landfills. And at some point, you know, we're going to run out of space. And, you know, how much stuff is in landfills and how can we actually take some of that out as a growing, you know, because we're impacted now and it's remiss to say that what's happening with the rise of a middle class in China and in India and, you know, countries in Africa, that middle class is also rising, which furthers demand. It means that we kind of really do have to think about and solve all these problems. And so, you know, I think about how much waste I have, you know, as a single person who tries to recycle, you know, I try to recycle everything I can. Here we try to recycle everything I can. You know, I look at that box from Amazon, which they sent, which I'm going to recycle, but it's like, you know, are there other ways we can improve this and do this better? And I think you're going to start to see more and more pieces and thoughts on that. So,
I like it. So for a last step forward in the future to imagine, let's take the year 2312 as our point. It's about 300 years. It's 295 years in the future as a reference point. That was in the past, the year 1722. So pretty significant changes from then till now. And we're going to think about that even further into the future. So again, as a reference point, in 1722, North America was still dominated by Native First Nations peoples. There's inroads of colonization happening from Europe. Philadelphia was already a city at that point. It was about 40 years old. But the United States itself would not emerge as its own nation for another half century from then. So if we take the year now, 2017, and launch 295 years to the year 2312, what does Philadelphia feel like, look like, almost 300 years from now?
I guess I would start to say, what does the United States look like and feel like, right? And I think that looks and feels very different. I think the idea that of what constitutes an American will be felt very differently.
Will there be an America?
I think there still will be an America. I have no idea what it's going to look like, right? I think climate change may allow or push people to band together in ways that they hadn't done before. And... So I think that, you know, I think there'll be some version of America because I don't think that the people who, I think there will always be a group of people who will say, you know, we're American, we're here. And then I think also given the breadth and size of the country, I think it will actually wind up helping it keep to stay together. So I think from a standpoint of a population, you know, I think you're going to see... the city itself, like I said, there at some point you kind of reach a capacity of a city, right? Unless you start to expand. So I think the city will definitely reach that capacity. I think what you're going to start to see more of is people generating energy from their own body, right? And, you know, we forget that our molecules are moving, we're developing, we're doing things, we're not a static people, and that we actually do, you know, that, like, say what you want about the Matrix, but that idea of the humans as like a battery, we actually have that. So I think you're actually going to start to see more wearable technology or more things where it's going to be super commonplace to accept the fact that we create and generate energy and we transfer that, you know, that kinetic physical energy to our, you know, whatever our computers or what have you look like then, I think you're going to start, you won't see like computers like we see them now. I think you still see screens because we're very visual, but I think the idea of like screens will basically be something you pull out of your pocket and it opens up, very similar to that. I think humans are humans, and so I think, you know, I mentioned this last time, but my uncle, who was 102 when he passed, you know, he had been on this earth for 100 plus years, and people don't change. Like in 1722, you know, people were probably doing the same thing. And if you read, and I laugh because I'm like, you know, people are doing the same like reality shows. It just played out differently, right? It played out in newspapers, but it was like we're gonna stretch the truth, or like, you know, they were Facebook back then, right? And so I think, you know, human nature will still be human nature, but I think we'll have the ability to create outlets for people to be able to really be, particularly as they think about education and think about, you know, once you've kind of fulfilled, you know, that basic hierarchy of needs, now you have, you're going to be able, because I think we'll have solved for that, right? I think we'll have solved for how do we feed people? How do we give them energy? Because it will be cheap. And it really should be free, right? It's one of those things that it creates a basic need. So it really should be, and well, let me rephrase that. It should be free to the extent that it costs. Like, you obviously pay for upkeep and pay for what you use, right? Because you don't want to create a commons problem. But it should be something that we've solved for people who don't have access to it. So
I like it. How are people moving around 300, almost 300 years from now?
I think in 300 years, people are moving through like lanes of like personal jetways, right? Like, I think it's not an actual jet, but like a little jetpack or something. I also think we're still going to be walking, but I think you're going to have some form of where you're moving people through express lines, like similar to like what Elon Musk wants to do, which I think is fantastic. Or you're going to have like lanes of where people, you know, can have, like, if you're here, like, you can actually start to use the sky a little bit more. So I think you're going to have like a high express for like emergency traffic, like that's higher, you know, kind of mid traffic, people walking on the ground. So I think it's going to look vastly different than it looks today.
How, what does that mean for Philadelphia? So try to picture what that, you're imagining this future. How does that change the way Philly, does it change the way Philly looks? Is it the rivers, are they different?
I think you'll start to see a lot more skyscrapers. I think you're going to have a lot of the historic buildings are going to obviously be kept for historic reasons. And so you're going to have that and have people kind of walking through time. But I think the newer buildings, the more modern buildings, I think particularly on the once you get outside of Center City and Old City, you're going to like have rows of homes that are just going to look completely different, right? They're going to say, this doesn't work. You know, climbing stairs, why would we climb stairs? Like, here's a button and I shoot up. Which means that I think our fitness is going to look very different, right? Our bodies are made to move. And so I think you're going to have something where, you know, at work or through some other mechanism, people are moving their bodies.
And is that related to this idea of our bodies producing the energy?
Our bodies produce energy, but literally, like, our bodies are designed to move. Like, if we don't move, we rot. Like, that's a physical, like, we atrophy, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why they come in. Even if you're, no matter what happens to you, they move your body, because our bodies are designed to be alive, to move, to walk, to feel. And so we need to figure out, as we kind of try to figure out how to move people efficiently, how to also create opportunities for that, right? You know, before with my uncle, you know, he grew up on a farm, so he always moved, and he died a farmer, right? So he worked different places, you know, different points in time, but that idea of this longevity can't happen unless people are actually doing something that, you know, expends, because energy transfers itself, right? It's no matter who's neither created or destroyed. I think the same thing, aside from spiritual energy, I think you can actually create spiritual energy, right? Like, you don't have this unlimited supply of it. But like, when you're creating, when I'm working out, you know, saying like I should be tired, but like because I've been working out more, like that just naturally gives me energy. Mm-hmm. Because I'm expending, it's crazy, I'm expending energy, but I'm getting it back like double. Mm-hmm.
With the bodies that are moving and creating energy at the same time, is the other components of energy, are they that's powering people's lives and these skyscrapers and the jets that are flying, people, personal flying machines, is that still solar generated?
I think it's still solar. I think it's even more solar.
More solar.
Right, because the sun is there, it's equal, and it's free for everybody, right? But what you're paying for is the idea of how to connect it and transform it. But I think it's, you know, it's around. And so I think it's even more solar. And I think you'll see definitely no coal, just because, again, the environmental, and I tell people it's not the burning of the coal, which also causes issues. It's what do you do with the ash, right? That's a significant question that people didn't think to ask 100 years ago. Now we're starting to see the impacts of that. And so I think you'll still see a little bit of natural gas, but by then I think, again, we're going to learn how to reuse and recycle energy in different ways. So
great. Is there anything else about the visions of the future that you wanted to share?
No, I think visions of the future
for Philly in particular.
For Philly in particular, I think Philly will, I think one of the things you'll see, like I would say 50 years out, which for me is definitely something you'll see, the city itself is administratively more automated and more technologically advanced, right? I think you're starting to see some of that happen, but from a standpoint of, if I look at other cities, Philly just is starting to come up, right? And I've seen the impact of that on ability to provide services, right? When you can actually have these things be automated. And that means now you can actually still have the same number. You can serve more people with the same number of government employees, right? I can serve more people if my time is freed up because the system's doing, you know, 25% of my work. That means I can now service 25% more people. So I think in the shorter term, that's really going to have an impact. I think one of the things, you know, thinking strategically about Philly, and I didn't realize this, but Philly actually has been a pioneer in renewable energy, you know, from windmills and from shipyards and doing a lot of things, and I'm actually trying to pull together more data on this. But I think it creates the opportunity from an administrative, you know, policy level, if Philly starts to really look at, okay, where do we want to be in 50 years and what are the levers that we need to pull to make that happen? And so, you know, looking, obviously, it's always in envisioning, you're always more comfortable with the shorter term, but I definitely think you'll start to see easier access for people starting businesses, you know, starting to do more incubators. Like I was walking around, there's a new WeWork set up right up the street. And that's great, because what that means is that you have small businesses that they you know, they have a few other spaces in the city, but they ran out of space there. So that means there's more people that need that space, right? And that creates jobs, that creates opportunities, that creates things like looking at apps where you can start to engage people in different ways, right? I think one of the things you'll also start to see is making it easier, like in Philadelphia, to find and connect with people, because we still need that, right? And so, yeah, I'd say... say that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's...
How do those things relate to energy in your vision?
In my vision, connecting with people still is the most fundamental important part of being a human being. And we've seen studies, we know this for a fact. I think energy facilitates that, right? So when you have energy and you have electricity, again, with your lights on, now I can have people at my house at night. Right? When we're all off work and we all come just hang out and again chill, and we might not be doing anything and we might just be sitting there listening to music and talking. And so having that ability to be able to connect with people or to provide, you know, people aren't worried about, am I going to be cold when I go home? That allows them to shift and focus on other things.
Great. So. Thank you so much for taking time
to be part of this. Yeah, no, thank you for coming back.